Good morning. You're listening to Winning at Life. I'll help you with the topic. It's live financial news talk radio. We're here for the next 3 hours. We can take your calls because we're live. You want to talk about money? That's what I want to talk about. You want to talk about retirement? Okay. Want to talk about annuities? Okay. Investments? Or the things you dislike about them?
I'm your co-host, James Parker. Gregory, you're going to love what I did with the call we had earlier in the week where John and Metairie upset about the law changes that went into effect this week that totally turned over the table on his financial plan. I broke it down into three little parts. You're going to love it. It's perfect for you. I just want to start with the news of the week. We got to get you caught up on what happened financially this week. And we turned over a new leaf into a new year, into a new decade. And it started pretty good. Here was the Fox Business Report at the close of the markets on Thursday.
Drop the confetti. The markets start the new year at new all-time highs on People's Bank of China stimulus and just positive attitude for 2020.
Wow, those are some good numbers, kicking off the decade with records on Wall Street. All three major averages ending at record highs on the first trading day of the year.
They didn't seem to matter that some Iraqi general or Iranian general got blowed up the day before. It was like, yeah, we saw that. We're still going to go to all-time highs.
Well, that was on Thursday.
Yeah.
And that evening, wasn't it when it was released that it whacked a couple generals?
I'm not sure about the timetable there.
Okay. Well, I caught the news that evening, and it obviously was released after market close. It didn't have an impact on the markets that day. And yeah, it is a great way to start the year. How much you want to get into the Iraqi general and such?
Just the financial angle.
Well, here is the thing. It creates concern because you don't know what Iran's going to do. Iran, Iran, you know, it's kind of the same place. Okay. You don't know what they're going to do. And then we obviously are of less tolerance with them at this point. So it creates, you know, quite a bit of concern, but you know, it was kind of bold of them and their general. You're creating havoc. You're pushing against other countries.
Tried to storm our embassy.
You're creating havoc, and you just said, well, you know, we're going to fly on over to Iraq, Baghdad, and we're going to go take a ride and talk to some of our leaders over there, creating havoc. And at that point, I think the embassy thing was kind of like you push too much with getting that going and threatening our embassy over there. So drones in action.
Yeah, and maybe you shouldn't be tootling around in your Toyota Tundra or whatever it is in a congressionally authorized combat zone right after you got your militia to storm our embassy.
Yeah, but it's pretty bold to think you're going to go over there, get off your plane, which everybody knows you're there. We see everything in that region, and just going to go tooling around. Who do you think you are? I guess they thought they were in charge.
You're just going for a relaxing evening drive. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, kind of a surprise. No, that's still our domain to observe and take action in.
Well, we talked about on the show before, whenever there's been major airstrikes, even if the market seems to be rattled in the week that it happens, 90 days out, it's completely immeasurable. It is statistically gone.
So takes us to Friday, where oil prices kind of moved up a couple dollars a barrel, and it already had kind of moved up because of supply reduction. And then the market reset everybody, says, yeah, we started off with a big up day, but you know, there's still down days. So it kind of set that in place as well on Friday. So the market ended up down.
Also, when you look at what's going on financially speaking with the Soleimani, I guess it's an assassination. I don't know. I mean, he's in a combat war zone, so it's not really an assassination, just a casualty of war. But the spike on oil could have been a lot bigger than it was yesterday. We've seen bigger spikes than that happen within a one-day period.
I saw a talking head yesterday that was talking about their projection is, you know, oil could go to, he's expecting it to go to 80. And he said, And they said, are you right? He says, yeah, I think we could see an upside towards 80, but it could even go to 100. Well, that's some pretty ugly stuff for oil to move that way when we just really haven't had any reason for prices to move like that. That would have to get, something has to happen really ugly, I think, for oil to be disrupted and move that high. That means somebody that's producing oil, major producer, has to shut down. Well, it's not Iraq.
Right.
It's not Iran. So I don't know what they feel that threat could be, but the main thing is we don't need their oil, so it's not impacting us either. I'm not quite seeing that, and I don't think something gets that ugly.
2007, when oil got above $140 a barrel, that was pretty catastrophic to our economy. I mean, that's basically, you could peg, that's one of the things that helped grind that winning streak to a halt and kind of kick off the 2008 recession. But it wouldn't be nearly as disastrous as it is now, what, 12 years, 13 years later, because we're a net oil exporter. We have a larger share of the global market. And yeah, we would be paying more for oil, but some of our companies would be making a lot more from oil, and we would have a bigger piece of the worldwide pie from those high prices.
And we have more capacity. Oil price goes up, we'll produce more.
Yeah, and we're almost at, what, double the production we were doing on a day, barrels per day function there.
And what was that number I gave you? The world uses 100 million barrels a day.
Was it 100 million? I think it was like 18 million. Crud. Those are way different numbers, though.
Yeah, it is just kind of staggering how much the world uses every day, and it just keeps using and keeps being supplied. Just like never ending.
All right, I would say the second biggest story of the week should have been the Secure Act, the changes that came in the laws that went into effect on Wednesday. Gregory, we've been watching the news for over 3 days now, and I've heard, aside from a couple mentions on Fox Business, nothing about this.
Well, back to the oil.
You got the number?
I'm pretty accurate on that number, 100 million barrels a day. So just clarifying that. Now back to the Secure Act, setting every community up for Retirement Enhancement Act of 2019.
All right. In the next segment, we're going to go through John's call. John in Metairie called in. He was coming in hot, rightfully so. He's going to be one of the people negatively affected by this. And he's going to be negatively affected by a few of the different points that changed. This totally upsets his plan. But just before we get into the specifics, what's some of the general things people need to know about the changes that went into effect on Wednesday?
RMDs or pushback required minimum distributions now start at age 72.
And this is for IRAs, 401ks, both?
Qualified plans.
That's all of them, okay.
Qualified plans required minimum distribution start at age 72. Another big impact from it is you can continue contributing to a traditional IRA beyond age 70, as long as you're working and have earned income. For those that are needing to continue working and put away more money, great opportunity. It also enhances backdoor Roth opportunities as well. Another really big one is the stretch IRA is gone. It has been eliminated.
Some people are not going to be too happy with the changes they're going to be forced to make. Now, Gregor was talking about how they bumped up the RMDs and they lifted the cap on contributions and they did a few other rules, but you'll notice the rule changes tend to favor people who are behind, who haven't been saving, people who need to catch up, people who got a late start, or people who haven't saved enough. And what we have here is John in Metairie, a guy who has done the right thing, who has been disciplined this whole time, who has saved enough, who has maximized his use of these retirement savings vehicles. He was talking about his IRA, but this could easily translate over to a 401k, 403b, whatever. And the way it works out is, if you're going to give help and change the rules to accommodate the people who didn't do the right thing, so often people who do the right thing have to pay some of that cost. And this is where John comes in. I broke his call up into three segments. He basically had three main complaints. And since Gregory and I have more time on the Saturday show, instead of just playing you the whole call, I'll play you his three complaints. And since Gregory has more time, he'll elaborate a little further than we did on the call, actually. So first thing John and Metairie was concerned about, complaining about, correctly identifying, is that losing the stretch option stinks. He was counting on it. Now he's scrambling to find a replacement, and it just doesn't feel fair.
Hey, so the Secure Act, it passed overwhelmingly. I just wanted to get your thoughts on how can any individual in this country make any planning on investments and taxes when for years, if not decades, people put money into IRAs for various reasons, one of which may have been to take advantage of the stretch IRA for their kids and grandkids. And then the government comes in and completely changes things and renders a lot of people's, you know, not retirement planning, but IRA planning and putting money in that vehicle to take advantage of the stretch IRA, and basically renders it almost worthless compared to what it was before. And then they lob an extra 1.5 years where we don't have to take the RMD, which is a joke.
All right, so there's John. The stretch option is something he was counting on. Now, there's not a whole lot we can do about the rule changes. That's the law of the land. And whatever amount of letter writing or whatever, it's not going to change it. So the thing we need to do is, what's John's backup plan? What can he do to replace what he had with the stretch?
Well, here's the problem. Large IRA owners are looking for more control of their money that they're leaving behind. They want the money to last. They would prefer it to be generational. And they want to also protect that money from misuse. So that's why trusts were important, but an important part of trust is that it had RMDs. So conduit trusts worked pretty well because they were passed through trusts and the RMDs would feed out. Now, discretionary trusts still work, except it, you know, trusts are taxed at the highest tax rate. So that's totally inefficient to want to be put money someplace where it's going to be stuck at the highest tax rate. People that have large amounts of money, what do they dislike most? Taxes. We have to pay taxes, but do you have to pay max taxes? Not if you don't have to. And so discretionary trusts are kind of like not an option. So then we're going to have to go and look at how do we shift money but minimize tax exposure. Life insurance could be a way. Charitable remainder trusts are another consideration. Roth conversions, more emphasis on these other areas.
You had mentioned life insurance too. How could life insurance play a role in some of that?
Life insurance would be to kind of define this here, where we're setting up an irrevocable life insurance trust. So you can set up a trust that kind of protects the estate value as well with proper structuring on a life insurance trust. But what you would do is start taking distributions to pay for the life insurance. What does the life insurance have a unique ability to do? Pay out money without it being taxed. It's a tax-free death benefit. So you could create your own personal stretch program and design it however you want to, because you're doing it with tax-free dollars. Why not take taxable dollars and fund non-taxable dollars? That's what we're doing, is kind of the thinking of, okay, well, I've got to spend some money here, but I can leverage that and create much more on the back end.
John and Metairie's second big complaint is, de facto speaking for John, this is a tax increase. And he's not very happy about that, Gregory.
Hang on. You know, you hit the nail on the head. It's a backdoor tax increase that is not slapping us in the face for a lot of people that may not understand it well enough. It's a tax increase. And the fact that it passed with such bipartisan support is just a mystery to me. It really hurts the people that have done the right thing for years and decades, trying to save money, stashing it away in retirement programs, which everybody, the government guys like you, everybody says to do. For people that listened and tried to do the right thing and didn't consume the last nickel they earned and be a burden to the government in 30 years, they're sticking it to us hard. And I don't really think that the great majority of the population understand that it is, in fact, a tax increase.
Yeah,
you know, it's a back. You hit people saying, "Oh, it's a Secure Act." Well, that's the biggest misnomer that I've ever heard of.
They always come up with the catchy acronyms there. I wonder how much time was spent on that to get the Secure Act.
Far too much. Such an eye rolling
because I think they spent less time on other parts of it. It changes the thinking, and actually in the long run it might be better, because what's happening with these large accounts and $1 million IRAs are a lot more commonplace. It's a record number of people have those now. But actually what you're leaving behind is tax infested money. And it's just going to get worse, because we know what tax rates are going to do in the future. They're going to go up, and we have great opportunity. There's a big jump in tax rates from 24% to 32%. So many IRA owners convert up to the top of 24% tax bracket, or to the top of the 12% tax bracket. Thus, many traditional IRA dollars can now be converted possibly to tax-free IRA dollars at only 24% or even less. So we're talking about even, and I've been talking about tax bracket management so much in 2019, I'm going to talk about it even more in 2020 this year. It's really important, knowing tax rates are going to go up, that we can shift money at this lower tax rates and not waste tax brackets there, because what we know is taxes are going up. So if you're leaving behind these big tax infested accounts, what's going to happen is, these are spend down, and the government, they know, they said, we're going to have a change at the White House at some point, and we're going to raise taxes. You know, the D20, the original 20 Democrats that were running for office, they all got up there and every one of them talked about raising taxes. And I'm not just going to blame it on them. Republicans are probably signing off on it at some point as well. Why? We spend $1 trillion more than we take in every year. And I think, mark my words, we'll see expenditures double. It'll get, $1 trillion deficit is commonplace. Well, guess what? We're probably going to get to move towards $2 trillion a year in deficit spending. So what do you think is going to happen? Yeah, these big IRAs are having to be spent down, even your small ones too. Everybody doesn't want to spend them down. Well, they're going to get spent down, and they're going to get taxed heavily.
Yeah, we have another clip from John in Metairie coming up, but I thought it was interesting. He pointed out how bipartisan this act was, how it passed with the overwhelming approval of both political parties.
Let me just throw in here. Do you understand, for a non-spouse beneficiary that has to take this money out over 10 years, and they're making an okay income, but all of a sudden they've got to start taking out, and they're jumping tax brackets. It's going to be a huge negative impact for non-spouse beneficiaries.
Okay, so we're going through the Secure Act. This is a bill that was wrapped into the spending bill that passed over the holidays. It went into effect on Wednesday, drastically making changes to IRAs, 401ks, retirement accounts, contribution, distributions, how they're passed along to your heirs and how you can inherit them. And it's a big mess, because now a bunch of plans, they just got the table flipped over and they're going to have to be rewritten. John in Metairie came in on the show Thursday. He was pretty hot about it, made a couple of great, they're complaints, but they're valid. Number one, losing the stretch IRA is a big loser for him. It's a big loser for his heirs. The options are not as clean in what he was planning on. Second, he didn't like the fact that it looks like, net speaking, he's going to get a tax increase out of this, and they're sacrificing him, the people who save, the people who've been piling money in the IRA like they're supposed to for the last few decades and have a nice little pile in there. They're sacrificing him for the people who are behind trying to play catch up, people like myself, really. This was his final complaint. He's like, this just all feels wrong. It feels like I'm being punished.
I think it's a horrible thing to do to the percentage of the population that tried to do the right thing and save for retirement and take advantage of the laws. Now they have a captive audience of people like me that have stashed probably too much money into an IRA, and now they're going to have it stuck to their heirs that we're supposed to be able to take advantage of a stretch IRA. Had I known that they'd come in the seventh inning in my life and change the rules, I'd have probably invested outside of an IRA, let the account grow, and take advantage of the step-up in basis.
I still say, okay, in one way, they simplified a few things with this law, but they're also creating heavier taxes for non-spouse beneficiaries inheriting that. Think about somebody inheriting a $2 million IRA. And even if they spread it out, that's $200,000 they're taking out a year over 10 years. Because there is no, to be clear, the stretch is gone. There is no RMDs. When's the required minimum distribution? It's year 10. And it's the, what is it defined as? It's the balance of the account is your required minimum distribution. Years 1 through 9, you don't have to take anything, but knowing that money's going to come out. And if it's a big IRA, why would you wait to the last year? Because now you've pushed into max tax bracket. So then you have to think about, how do I maximize tax efficiency? Is you have to start distributions and spread them out. But think about it, if it's a 2 million account, that's 200,000 a year on top of that non-spouse beneficiary. It's on top of their income. And yeah, that's pushing into heavy tax brackets, and you're being punished in that way for saving. But what it's going to cost, because I think planning has been easy under the previous system because of the stretch. Didn't, like, gosh, they're only taking out a small, it's not going to really crunch tax brackets that much, supplemental income, and at a decent rate of return. That IRA, even though it's an inherited account, keeps growing over that beneficiary's lifetime. And now it's kind of like, okay, this is a problem. They changed the rules. But actually, it took away the simple way. And now there's a little bit of work to do, but actually, because now you have to make some other decisions, you actually will start think about and take action on to something that makes it even better. And that is to do tax efficient planning on that money left behind. And you can probably do it in a way that you're leaving all that money behind without it being taxed. And I think that's the great thing, because it's the easy way. Well, I don't have to do that because it's going to be the stretch. Taxes are going to be that big a deal. Well, now taxes are going to be a really big deal. So let's do some planning and really create something that's great to leave behind.
See, this makes me look forward to the talks we're going to have, because next week our guest is Wes Blanchard. He's the estate planning attorney. Y'all are working on workarounds as we speak.
We are hard at work on this. There's another number of conference calls I'm going to be on next week. I'm doing additional studying, and we're going to be rolling some of this out at our events here in the coming weeks. And I'm really excited about it now. Okay, well, let's get down and let's do some planning there and start showing people how to do this and do this workaround and make this actually even better, because you have to do something. The other way, it's lazy way. We got the stretch. Taxes aren't going to be a big impact. I don't have to fool with this other planning. Okay. Well, now the easy way's gone. And Uncle Sam wants your money and is going to get it if you don't do anything. Or we can really dig down and let's do some planning.
This kind of sounds like what I've sort of been explaining to my kids. When you get to be an adult, the studying and the schoolwork doesn't stop. You're going to have your job plus homework on top of it. And if you're looking at this camera angle over here, see that big stack of folders and spirals and binders and stuff? You're constantly going to other events and reaching out to other organizations that help financial advisors keep up with these rule changes. And you basically digest a college course when you go to these things.
I do a lot of reading on a daily basis, outside of going to conferences and other things that are showing up on my plate. And, look, early in the career, I've always kind of been a reader, somebody that's about self-improvement, but I did for a period of time get over it. Like, when do I have to stop learning? Because it's always, I'm having to do continuing ed. I'm always having to be tested, which is a normal thing in life for me. Throughout the year, I'm having to do material, take tests, for continuing ed and with some of the products, the companies we work with. Look, even the government on money laundering requires us to do certain stuff each year. And at one point I was like, my gosh, when does this ever stop? And then I corrected, didn't take long, but I corrected my thing. Since we have to do this, let's embrace it and do even more and be at the top of the game. That was an attitude shift. So if you're thinking studying is done when you finish school, whether it's high school or college, change your mind shift. I'm going to tell you something here that's going to help you make more money, the young people listening. The more you know, the more you're going to make.
I think we need to spend a little more time on what happens to the people who are inheriting your money. So let's do it from the point of view of what happens if my mom or dad passes away and I'm inheriting an IRA. What do I got to do? What does the Secure Act leave me with as far as my options on that IRA that's being passed down?
That IRA, assuming if she has an RMD due, it has to be, you know, in the year of her death, if there's an RMD not paid, we're assuming that's going to still have to be shored up.
Okay.
But under the old rule, year after death, you would have to start taking required minimum distributions. Here's the good news. You don't. You have 10 years to take out that money. And if you don't do so during the first 9 years, year 10 is a required minimum distribution of 100%. It's pretty simple from that standpoint. You're not having to like, gosh, did I miss my RMD? If I don't take any time, I'm going to get a 50% penalty for not taking it. No, you don't. Now, I don't know what the penalty is year 10 if you don't take the rest out. It could well still be the 50%, but, you know, the Treasury, the IRS still has to work out some details on that, but they're not kidding. They want that money taken out. It's a taxable event and penalized of some sorts if you don't do so. But from the easy standpoint, you haven't got to worry about, did I take it? Did I take the right amount? You don't have to do anything, actually.
You don't have to fill out a form. You could just let it sit there in the account and wait till year 10, and then the IRS will...
Yeah, and look, they could have some defined rules that, yeah, you've got to shift that money into an inherited account, properly titled inherited account at some point. But there's no RMDs required along the way. It's just you have to take the money out within 10 years. There's no stretch. There's no RMDs. Unless you arrive at year 10 and there's still money in that account. So from that standpoint, I'd say it's simpler and there's nothing for you to mess up.
Now, is the titling still the same issue? If my mother was passing an account down to me, the first thing I would do is go to you and say, I've heard shows where you talked about how people have screwed up their life by messing up the title on an IRA.
It's still going to have to be a properly titled inherited account, because it's also going to have to differentiate from the exceptions, the five or six exceptions to that are allowed to continue to stretch the money over their lifetime, which isn't many and mostly has to do with spousal beneficiaries get to continue to take money over their lifetime. They're not required to spend it down, but you want to differentiate from those accounts and properly titled. And the IRS is going to know about that money and it needs to be properly titled still. But you're not under any pressure to make decisions. You don't have to spend it if you don't want to.
All right. Pardon me.
Until year 10.
If this is oversimplified, that's because I don't do this for a living. But it seems like from a tax standpoint, if I did inherit that big chunk of money, I would want to spread it out fairly evenly over 10 years to minimize taxes, not knowing what my income is going to be like in year 8 or whatever. But just generally speaking, is that sort of the approach you want to take?
You're going to have to do tax bracket management.
There you go. All right. So what else do we need to know about the Secure Act?
Well, actually, I want to share something with you that I think is really important that we haven't talked about. And this was in November of 2019, that the IRS proposed regulations updating life expectancy tables used for determining required minimum distributions under IRAs and other retirement plans. So something else that was on, you know, kind of on the down low. The new tables reflecting increased American longevity at a small but measurable increase to everybody's life expectancy. The revisions affect three tables that have been used since 2003. The last time this was updated was back in 2002. So the revisions are to the single life table, which is used for determining payouts to an eligible designated beneficiary under the SECURE Act, as well as payouts from inherited retirement plans that are grandfathered under the new law. Remember, if there was a death prior to 2020, that's grandfathered under the new law. So the stretch still remains for those. The second table is the Uniform Lifetime Table, used for determining lifetime required minimum distributions to most plan participants over age 72. And the third table that's revised is Joint and Last Survivor Table, used for lifetime payouts to participants over 72 with sole beneficiary who is a spouse more than 10 years younger than the participant.
Interesting. You know, those are some significant changes, but did that have to be approved by Congress? They just changed that in committee? It's pretty interesting.
Well, it's an IRS proposal, so the IRS is going and looking at that. It wasn't part of the bill. And an example of somebody having a $1 million IRA, that change could, you know, be somewhere around $2,100 effect on lowering the RMD that they're having to take, the required minimum distribution. And the factors increase, but lowers the amount. It's small, but it is measurable.
Okay.
Savings with the changes that are coming. And we're not expecting, just to be clear, they have not finished work on that. They probably will finish it sometime this year, but it's expected to take effect, those reductions, in 2021, to be clear.
All right. So the SECURE Act, a lot of laws changed around a 401k or someone else has an IRA or 403b. Some of these rules have changed. We got to keep you updated on that. This isn't the most entertaining or sexy part of the show, but this is probably the most important part of the show you're going to hear today.
Well, I think in the last hour we come across that this actually will push people to actually do more planning, which will probably give them more opportunities to create something that can be left behind and be done so more tax efficiently. Because really what has happened with these changes overall, I would have to say it can be defined as a tax increase. Because here's six changes. Number one, eliminates the age limit for making traditional IRA contributions. Number two, it increases the required minimum distribution age to 72. Allows penalty-free withdrawals for birth or adoption. Allows taxable non-tuition fellowship and stipend payments to be treated as compensation to qualify for an IRA or Roth contribution. Number five, it provides employer liability protection for annuities in plans. The biggest impact is safe annuities are going to become available inside of company plans. And number six, it eliminates the stretch IRA, which is what turns the whole thing, because it overshadows everything else, into a tax increase.
A good summary on some of the stuff we're covering this hour, if you go to GregoryRicks.com, that's the name of my buddy across the table here, GregoryRicks.com, go to the blog section, and the top story we have right now is something that we found on Forbes. Six ways to the SECURE Act may impact your retirement. And when you get a chance to do a little reading on your own, start there.
The S&P 500 has gained an average of 10.6% per year. That's total return over the last 50 years. The index has been positive in 15 of the last 17 years. Over the long term, the S&P 500 has been up during 40 of the last 50 years. That's 80% of the time. I know all the negative parts are really, really bad problems and bombers, but it's up most of the time. You know, that's one reason index linked investing works really good. We like participation rate on that, but that's where you can capture through utilizing index linked strategies. You're capturing the upside of the market.
Oh, I see where you're going with this. And yeah. Now you can get those in your 401k or IRA possibly.
Yeah, possibly as we go there. Let's see. That was just a thought. Here's another one I think is really neat. The 8.7% total return for Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index in 2019 was the best calendar year result since 2002. The widely followed bond index created in 1986 is backdated history calculated to 1976 has produced a negative total return for the calendar year in just 3 years of the last 44 years, only 7% of the time. You know, that's why, you know, what I kind of talk about bonds, why bonds should be in the mix is they just keep you moving forward. There's only two, well, I won't give that stat, but you know, that is really a great number.
So bonds seem to have a little more stability than investing in individual stocks. They seem to have a more stable, not as volatile, not as big and eye-catching, but more stable returns and more positive returns. But somehow stocks seem to be more popular.
Yeah. Once again, I produced a negative total return in just three of the last 44 years. Well, let's look at it a little bit differently. The taxable bond market was up 8.77% in 2019 and has gained 5.9% per year over the last 30 years. The Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, calculated using publicly traded investment grade government bonds, corporate bonds, and mortgage related securities with at least 1 year until final maturity, was used as the bond measurement. But that's another good stat, is taxable bond market was up 8.7% in 2019 and has gained 5.9% per year total return over the last 30 years. You know, when I go back to what, you know, how I kind of talk about the 50-50 money management strategy, subject to risk tolerance, but my belief for most people, they should somewhere be in the neighborhood of probably 50% of the money connected to Wall Street and 50% connected to index linked. But when we get to what we're talking about on Wall Street money, I think half of that money should probably be correlated to U.S. stocks and the other 50% correlated to the U.S. bond market. And that gives you a little basis of why I think money should be correlated to bonds. They just keep you moving forward. Now, also why we should have money correlated to stocks. I gave you the numbers there of how they've been up over the long term. They've been up, the S&P 500 has been up during 40 of the last 50 years. Okay. So there's a reason to have a connection there. Now, index linked, I'll just simply say what the strategy there is, to get the upsides of those indexes, but minimize the impact of those negative years that do come time to time, but are and can be devastating to portfolios, especially when taking income. So what we're really wanting to do with that strategy is we're correlating 75% of assets to the upside of the market. What I'd mentioned about the bond index, Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index in 2019 had a total return of 8.7%. That was the best calendar year since 2002. The widely followed bond index created in 1986 with backdated history calculated to 1976 has produced a negative total return for the calendar year in just 3 years of the last 44 years. From a percentage standpoint, it's only been negative 7% of the time.
Why aren't bonds more popular?
In my world, they are. I think it's an important part of the mix. Now, bonds do have risk, but what, you know, just that negative in 3 years of the last 44, I kind of, you know, having it in the mix, I speak of the financial cycle. I'll kind of, you know, we have the cycle of life and farming where everything kind of rotates to create where you've got stuff working and helping everything else. The cycle of financial life is a term I like to use, to where if you've got the right blend of asset classes, you keep your money moving forward for you. And bonds, I kind of define as, what do? They just kind of keep you always moving forward. You know, when the market had its big downturn in, what year was that? 2008.
Yes.
Yeah. Real ugly year. Bonds didn't have some ugly year like that in that year. So once again, that was something that kept you moving forward. So if we talk about the S&P 500 gained an average of 10.6% per year over the last 50 years. The index has been positive in 15 of the last 17 years. The S&P 500 has been up during 40 of the last 50 years, 80% of the time. So we love those positive years. It's, you know, of the 10 years that was down, that's the part we don't like, and that's the part that can really injure you and devastate you if you're taking income. But it was up 31.5% last year, which was a sweet year. The total return of the S&P 500 over the last 10 years was a gain of 13.6% total return. If you miss the 10 best percentage gain days over the last 10 years,
so that's one day
a year, the 13.6% annual gain falls to 9.2% annual gain. So being in when you have those best days, that's pretty impactive. Pretty impactive. Back to the SECURE Act.
Right. And what you just mentioned with the bonds, what you just mentioned with the state safety, the index linked investing, some of that just got a little more efficient, a little more fluid, because they're expanding the options you can have in these qualified plans to include some of this index linked investing. So this is good news for the 50-50-50 plan.
Yeah. And it ties into, once again, I'm excited about that because we do have the 401k maximizer, you know, my daytime job. We have a 401k maximizer program to help people to create balance and get the right blend subject to their risk number. Because most people just take in their 401ks, just plug money in and forget about it. They don't look at, should we be adjusting it? Am I overweighted in certain areas? They just keep plugging in money and it's not ever being looked at. They could even get guidance, and then they don't take the time, because we're all so busy in our lives. And I'm speaking of that seriously, we really are. So it's easy to forget some of the important things that you need to do, and your money is really important and we need to keep it growing. And if you can keep the right blend going, those stats tell you a lot in what we're trying to do.
Do the philosophical underpinnings of the 50-50-50 rule again. You kind of hinted at it there, to where you were talking about with the way things are spread out, you could have 75% of those assets linked to the upside of the market.
Well, yeah, when I break it down, once again, if 50% of the assets loosely correlated to your risk number, but 50% correlated to index linked investing, well, really what we're doing is we're correlating that money to the upside of stocks, of stock indexes there. But we're not exposing that money to negative side of that in that strategy. So on the other 50% that's at Wall Street, 50% of that is correlated directly into stock indexes there. So you're getting upside and downside. So, and of that other half of the Wall Street money is correlated to bonds. So what I just explained to you, the 50% index linked and 50% in stock indexes, you're getting 75% of your assets correlated to stocks. but that's correlated 75% of the assets to the upside of stock indexes. And if the market's going to go negative, we've only correlated 25% to be impacted negatively out of 100% of your assets. The other 25%, that's correlated to bonds, as I mentioned, which, what were those numbers? The Bloomberg Bond Index over right. the, what? Let's see, where's that number over the past 44 years? Only 3 negative years on bonds. And last year's pretty good year on that index, over 8%. Yeah, there's places to make money without doing scary things. Like, some people feel stocks are scary, and I don't disagree. They really can be. They can be disastrous at the wrong time. But bonds, kind of a little bit more conservative. Bonds do still have risk, but 8% last year, that's pretty good.
Well, you're the one who taught me when people are usually upset about losses in their financial plan, where does it come from?
There's stocks. Yeah. I never have anybody say, yo, yeah, these bonds are horrible. No, what they're complaining about is stocks. I either didn't make enough or I lost too much. I want to circle back to one other thing that we talked about last night, and that's fundraising. You still have your notes on the, you know, there's an election, big election here in 2020. There's probably a bunch, but the main one is this presidential election. And I think where the dollars go is like a pointer, you know, like the wind gauge, you know, which way is the wind blowing?
Weather vane.
Yeah. Which way is the wind blowing gives you an idea of what's going on, which way the money's flowing is a pretty big idea. And one of them is interesting. Elizabeth Warren had, I think she pulled in what, about 20 million this last quarter. Yeah. 21.2 million, which was a drop from the previous quarter where she pulled in over $24 million. So that's kind of a little bit of a direction right there.
It's a lot less wampum.
Yeah. But you've got some other information on some others.
Well, look, the money raising isn't a done deal. The guy who raises the most money doesn't always win,
but no. It
definitely tells you where the enthusiasm is at. And Bernie Sanders led the pack from the Democrat side of the aisle, $34.5 million in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, that's significant, and that's a spread. Now, Biden's still kind of leading that in the polls, but he's not leading in the money.
Yep. I think the polls are terribly misleading because the Bernie voters are split between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren right now. If Elizabeth Warren gets out, I don't see as many of her voters going to the Biden camp or the Buttigieg camp or anywhere else. They're going to go to Bernie Sanders in a plurality, at least, if not a majority.
Based on the money, I think she's on her way out. She's got money to hang. She'll probably make some impact in the convention. But still, it's a long year, and we've started not, you know, these elections, these mini elections.
Oh, the primaries and caucuses. Yeah. Yeah,
all that's coming up is going to tell the tale as well. But I kind of go back to, and look, this isn't a political show. It's just financial observations. But I tell you what, if that had been everything equal last time around, I don't know that Hillary, if it was a level playing field, I don't know that Hillary would have beat Bernie.
She would not have
last time. If it had been, it was all lopsided to her, even so much that she thought she was a lock no matter what for the White House. And that's why she took it so hard. But speaking on the other side, Trump last quarter raised what, $49 million. Yeah. Money's really flowing. He raised almost $500 million in 2019. Not far from it. So once again, that gives you an idea of where things are headed based on where the money goes.
Well, it's also interesting to remember that this guy won in 2016 and he got outspent in the presidential election by more than 2-1. So what's it going to look like when he's the guy with more money? You know, every once in a while I look at the data set that we're faced with. I'm like, we could be walking into like a 39 state landslide coming in November. Not that I'm necessarily the biggest fan of the guy in office, but his challengers are worse.
Well, just speaking of the flow of money gives you an idea of what direction it's going.
Well,
just like that wind and the weather vane.
And I think it's a better gauge of enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders donations are coming from smaller people. because $200 from a school teacher shows a lot more enthusiasm than $200 from ExxonMobil or something, right? I mean, that's a nothing thought for those guys, but for a teacher, and that's who's donating there. Look, Democrats, get out your own way. Stick with the guy that has a little more enthusiasm. You might like the result better. Not that I'm necessarily endorsing or condemning any candidate, but the money side of this speaks loudly. I am surprised, though, to see Pete Buttigieg took in $24.7 million. So this guy, he's beating Elizabeth Warren now. He was one of the guys that was in the 1% range just 6 months ago. We actually had one rise out of that. I saw just this morning Michael Bloomberg in some polls is already popping up to 3rd and 4th place in some polls. So it ain't over yet. I don't know what this is going to look like, but we're going to have the people making their first votes less than a month from now. If I'm not mistaken, Iowa caucuses are the first week of February this year.
Yeah, and look, we won't talk about this on every show, and this isn't a political show. We just kind of follow the money at times. And, you know, we even talk about that, you know, I'll relate it to football, you know, which NFL teams are going to have terrible seasons. The ones that have the highest dead cap space as well, the ones that have the lowest dead cap space tend to do better because they have a few extra players, and a few players can make a big difference. And then, you know, I know a group of happy coaches, and that's LSU's football coaches. All of them are getting bonus money and even more. They've got one more game to increase that pot of money that they're going to all share in.
I know they would be happy and do their best, even if there wasn't a bonus involved. But man, that's a nice little cherry on top.
It is a nice little perk at the end there.
All right, we have another hour left on the show. Our Texans, you're about to switch off from us. If you're listening on the TuneIn app as well to our Dallas affiliate, it's going to switch off. You can continue listening. Go to the Winning at Life app, and there's Listen Live on the top right hand of the front screen. There's 6 buttons. I mean, top left hand, that one says Listen Live. Click that and you're good to go for the last hour of the show. If we have time, can I squeeze in the statistician's look at New Year's resolutions? This guy that's runs stats for, his name's Norman, and he's a stats professor at MIT. He ran through so many studies and surveys that he found there's 3 ways for you to keep your New Year's resolutions that shows up in the numbers.
Okay, we should... once again, we're a numbers show, so right. I think that's a good topic for the next hour.
So the number one factor that a statistician at MIT found that made people most likely to keep their New Year's resolution is if you make it very specific. Don't say, I want to lose weight. Say, I want to lose 20 pounds, or I need to lose 24 pounds this year. You put a real number on a real goal, not just some ethereal concept of I want to lose weight. Second thing he said was take that specific goal and break it down into smaller parts. So I don't want to lose 24 pounds this year. I want to lose 2 pounds in January, 2 pounds in February, 2 pounds in March. It's the same number, but your brain digests it different, and it's huge. And then far below that, there was one other thing that actually had an impact. Everything else didn't have an impact at all. This one's it's kind of minimal, but worth a mention. Have a buddy system. Even if, you know, you say, I'm going to read a book a month, and you find a buddy that's going to read a book a month, you don't even have to read the same book. But if y'all are accountable to each other, that seems to trick your brain into actually following through with the promises you made yourself this week.
Accountability is really important. Being accountable to somebody, knowing that you've got to do this. You're either at some point going to say, look, dude, I know I'm supposed to be doing this and you're checking up for me, but I'm done. So don't worry about it anymore. So you're having to have that awkward conversation saying, I'm out. Otherwise, you're having to keep course and work, and that's whether it goes to weight loss or book reading or business goals that you have in your workplace or in your company to improve yourself.
Well, I'm trying this. You know, last year I said I'm going to pay down my credit cards. Well, all right, this year I'm going to pay down $2,400 on the credit cards. I'm going to do $200 a month. I'm going to try it.
Awesome.
All right. We had some big law changes that affect your money, your retirement accounts go into effect on Wednesday. We are going to spend some time today, next week, the week after that, keeping you updated on how these changes affect your money. We're going to give you certain action items to where if you're in this situation, you're going to need to do something. And so let's just start listing off before we get into the nuances of what the law changes were. Who needs to listen to these next couple of segments the most? I would say anyone that's close to their RMD, the required minimum distribution date.
Somebody
on IRA.
That's close to taking RMDs. Somebody that is planning on their money being left behind and stretched was the plan. And those that are wanting to save more money and working even later into life. The world consumes 101 million barrels of crude oil per day. That is just mind-boggling.
To know how big a million is, 100 of those, and how big's a barrel? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. And the U.S. actually consumes 20% of that number, 21 million barrels a day here in the U.S. alone. It's just staggering. And then, and that's every day. And tomorrow, going to consume another 100 million. And then the day after that, it just...
Well, all those people, when you're stuck in traffic, they are all burning oil right now, burning gas. So, ha, ha, ha. Look, I'm proud of that number. 20% of the world's oil usage is us. Good. Good. It means we're doing something right. Also means we can own cars. Of course, the people in Denmark don't use as much gas as we do. Only 20% of them can afford to own a car. I mean, they have free everything else, but hey.
Okay, how about this? The U.S. manufacturers have moved some of their supply chains away from China in 2019, increasing imports from Taiwan up to 22%, India 12%, South Korea up 12%. So that was some of the changes that we saw last year as well. There is a number here. Let me see. Where am I in the balance here? Overspend time. Almost even. Here it is. The USA has 121 companies in the Fortune Global 500 rankings for 2019 compared to 119 companies from China. This is going to be really a telling number for you.
I didn't know it was that close.
Yeah, 121 U.S. companies in the Fortune Global 500, and China has 119 companies.
I don't like that.
20 years ago, the USA had 181 companies in the Fortune Global 500 rankings, while China had just 5. How about that?
That's a staggering statistic. Hey, real quick before we get to the phones,
stunning.
You're doing something that we've never done before, the open house at your Gulfport office in Mississippi.
Yeah, we're doing that Tuesday from 5 to 7. There's no presentation. There's no Q&A. It's just casual. Come by, hang out, meet some of the team. I'm going to be there. And if you want to talk about something, fine, but we're not going to sit down, have some meeting or anything. It's an open house. Come by, see the office, check out the office. So for when you want to come in the future or something or talk to us, just super casual. We'll do some wine and cheese and some other things. And it's just come by and see us. Say hi. Check things out.
Yeah, and this isn't a
port office.
This isn't a business thing. No one's going to try and sell you anything or sign you up for anything. This is just sort of half open house, half housewarming party. Lorraine Road, if you go south from I-10, after you go over the big bridge, it'll be in a strip mall on your left. And it's a social event is what this is. Everyone's invited.
Yeah, there's nothing threatening. Nobody's going, let me have your information so we can set a meeting or whatever. No, just come by, hang out. If you want to do something beyond then, let us know. But, it's just super casual.
Well, also, here's a little secret of the pros. Gregory and Stacy have excellent taste in cheese, and it's cheese some of them I've never been exposed to before. So whenever I'm hanging out with y'all in one of those settings, I go straight for the cheese tray. That's my jam. All right, all that set up. If you have a financial situation, not quite sure what to do, phone lines are open. 504-260-0995. Robert in Hammond, you're on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. Hey, how can we help you, Robert?
Good morning, guys. I'm just unsure about something. Need a quick comment on it, if you would. I am I'm turning 68, and I'm taking Social Security, and I've got a part-time job. My wife is getting ready to turn 65 this month, and she is getting ready to retire. So my question is with respect to a spousal draw on my Social Security, would it be a good idea for her to kick that in, or should we just hang loose with that for a while? She's planning not to take Social Security till she's 70.
Okay. Is what year was she born?
She was born in 55.
Okay. So she, when she goes to turn it on, she's going to turn on whichever record is giving her the most, because she was born after January 1st of 1954. So she can't pick and choose. The rule is, if the spousal benefit's larger, that's what's going to be turned on. If her work record is larger, that's what's going to be turned on. She can't just take the spousal and defer the work record, because that rule changed back in 2016.
Okay.
Sorry for the bad news on that. But you could go and check with Social Security as well. And that's who you have to talk to turn on any benefits as well. Sure. But that's how the rule works now.
Okay. So I guess we'll just write it out until she doesn't want, we don't want the income really until she's 70 anyway. So, but again, with her retiring, I was trying to supplement that income a little bit.
Yeah. And that we used to be able to do that, where you could have restricted it to the spousal benefit and defer hers. But being she was born after January 1 of 1954, that option is no longer available to her.
Well, you've answered my question, my friend. I do appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening, Robert.
All right, Chris in Macomb, we're about to step into a break, but let's go ahead and get your question, and we'll probably get your answer after the commercials, unless it's just a one-sentence answer. How can we help you, Chris in Macomb?
I have a 401k that I contributed to all the way up from 2007 to 2014 with a company that I used to work for, and I'm obviously not with them anymore, but the account is still there. Would it benefit me to move that into an IRA, like any kind of IRA or somewhere other than what it's doing now?
I think it would, because it gives you a lot more choices outside, because you're just relegated to the choices within that. If you roll it over, which is a non-taxable event, to a rollover IRA account, you have a full universe of financial choices, whether it's risk-related or non-risk. You do have another choice. If you're currently working for an employer that has a 401k, you can move that money to that new 401k as well.
Does that help you, Chris, or you need some more time?
That's great for me. I just need to make up my mind between a Roth or a Raymond James, I guess.
Well, that's a little bit more confusion there on that answer. Hold on to the break. We'll talk a little more when we come back.
I'm James Parker. We're Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks.
Hey, this is Winning at Life, Live Financial News Talk Radio. We do take calls, 504-260-0995. I'm your host, Gregory Ricks. We went to break. We have Chris on hold here. We're going to bring Chris back up on the hotline, the Winning at Life hotline. He's calling from Macomb, had a 401k question, whether or not to, should he leave the money at the old job or roll it over to an IRA? And my vote is, that's like left behind money. It's in that old plan. You're just dealing with those choices. I think it should be better monitored. You might even seek help with it. You could be a do-it-yourselfer. I think a rollover IRA gives you a lot more choices, whether it's different risk choices or get into the mix, safe choices. You have a lot more options there, the full universe of them. You could even move it to your new job 401k. Now, Chris, right before we went to break, you mentioned Roth or Raymond James. That's two complete different concepts. Do I have you with us?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay. So I assume your 401k money is a traditional 401k account. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if you kind of went, well, do I move it to a Roth or Raymond James? Well, moving it to a Roth is a taxable event if it's a traditional 401k. So if you're doing a rollover, it's going to be a rollover to a traditional IRA, which would be a non-taxable event. If you were shifting that money to Roth from a traditional 401k, once again, you're creating a taxable event. So it would be a rollover IRA that you're doing. So your decision is, if you are going to do a rollover, then who are you placing it with would be the decision of where are you comfortable doing it yourself at, or shopping for help in that way. The firm you're working with now does not have a 401k?
No, sir.
Okay.
It's state retirement.
Okay. Now, a couple things we always look at in doing rollovers is if there's company plan money inside of the account. That's the kind of thing we address there. And another point we always check on doing rollover IRAs is there any after-tax money inside of that 401k? Because we want to separate that out when the rollover is done. So a couple things to keep in mind there, because if you have company stock, there could be a net unrealized appreciation opportunity in there that would need to be addressed. And do not roll over your after-tax dollars that may happen to be in the account. So those are two things to kind of look for. Do you have any other questions, Chris?
I'm good. Thank you so much. Oh,
okay, awesome. Thank you for listening to Winning at Life and share our show with a friend.
Yeah, and thanks for hanging on through the break there. If you want to be next, 504-260-0995. We're running through some of the legal rule changes that happened to your retirement accounts. It was called the Secure Act when it was off by itself. And then it got rolled into the spending bill in December, went into effect on Wednesday, and you just woke up into a new set of rules for your IRAs, 401ks, and some of that inherited money as well. Now, we covered the loss of the stretch. In this hour, I don't think we've talked about the moving up the required minimum distribution date from age 70 and a half to age 72.
Yeah, well, we talked about the stretch is gone except for five exceptions.
Oh, you're right. We didn't cover that.
So the five eligible classes, eligible designated beneficiaries exempt from the 10-year post-death payout rule means the money has to be taken out within 10 years. You don't have RMDs except for year 10, which the RMD is 100% of the balance of the inherited account. Those that are exempt, number one is a surviving spouse. Number two, minor children, but not grandchildren, up to age of majority. Once they reach age of majority, their 10-year distribution phase starts that they have to take it out. Number three is disabled individuals. Number four, the chronically ill. And number five, a beneficiary not more than 10 years younger than the IRA owner or plan employee. So those are the five exempts. Everybody else, you're going to have to distribute that inherited account inside of 10 years. And the only RMD that's involved is year 10, and it's called 100% of the balance.
Yeah, but I guess in year 10, it's still technically an RMD, but it would be a required maximum distribution for year 10. Same initials, just a completely different concept.
Yep.
You only have one R&D.
I like that. I like that. Required maximum distribution. So what was the other point? We've got six.
Pushing it up to age 72.
Yeah, kind of just giving a two-year deferral or what has been always 70 and a half, which is some complicated thing that didn't ever need to be that way. Why couldn't you just say when you're age 70, RMDs start? But no, it's 70 and a half.
Somebody, I'm not going
to
miss it.
Somebody wanted that. To complicate things, but now it's moved to age 72. So if, for example, if you had an RMD because you were 70 and a half last year, well, you don't have to take one this year. It'll restart for you when you turn age 72. Those turning 70 and a half in 2020 do not have to start it. They start it when they turn age 72. So that is a positive thing, and probably it impacts what 20% of the people don't want to have to take RMDs. You know, some people are taking income, and it's a positive thing. Once again, deferral costs the government some money, but on that other end, eliminating the stretch is going to make the government or the treasury a lot of money.
Barry in Baton Rouge, you're on Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Barry?
Thank you for taking my call. My son is 41 and he has an IRA, and he's thinking about moving it into a self-directed IRA and apparently investing it in like a rental cabin in the mountains, putting it in a rental program and having it managed. I don't know anything about that. He's asking my advice. Of course, I told him to go to a good financial advisor, but I just wanted to see if y'all had any thoughts on that.
My thoughts are is that is hazardous. Because you have to use a third party custodian that specializes in that. people that come to me to talk about that, I'm giving them the warnings. We won't do it for them or handle it, but you have to use a third-party administrator, which is tracking it. And it, just to simplify it, there's so many ways people can mess that up because the purchase of the property has to be done by the IRA. He can't, and it can't be in his name. It's got to be in the IRA's name. If the window breaks on the cabin, the IRA has to pay for it. He can't pay for it. If there's rental income, it goes in the IRA. He can't take a piece of that. Otherwise, you kind of blow up your account. So there's books out there. I'm kind of giving more of the warnings of why not to do it. And is that $40,000? I don't know. You didn't give us the amount of the IRA, did you, Barry?
I think it's about $300,000.
Okay. Well, hey, he can buy a nice cabin there.
But he might be better off financing it with the lower interest rates and just letting the rental income offset the note, right?
Yeah, I personally would not go and buy a business or real estate with my IRA. It restricts me, and there's too many things that can go wrong, and I don't want the IRS changing some rules later and really messing things up. They do scrutinize this more and more. So and there can't be self-dealing because he can't go rent that cabin to relatives either. Well, my son owns his cabin. Well, let's go up there and say, son, let me have the keys to the cabin for a month. You can't do any self-dealing on it either. So he can't use the cabin. You can't use the cabin. That doesn't work there. I'm not a big fan of it because most of the time people mess this up somehow and get a giant tax bill because their IRA is now disallowed. So yeah,
and
maybe
they could change rules in the future too, right?
Hey, we've got a whole 14-page document about just the outline, 14-page outline of the changes they did at the end of the year on IRA. So, yeah, they can have something great like the stretch has been used for a long time, and then all of a sudden it's gone. So be careful. That's my advice.
Okay, good. I'm going to I left my phone number, and I'm going to recommend that he, you know, maybe consult with you guys on this. Before he jumps off into something like that.
Okay.
Hey, Barry, how are you listening to us in Baton Rouge? We're not on Baton Rouge this hour. Oh, no, we are on Baton Rouge.
We
just picked this up. You're right. We picked it up a month ago.
I was going to say. Like,
yeah.
I'm listening to you on the radio. Yeah, I just turned it back on. I didn't want the sound to come through my phone. But, yeah, I listen to you guys a lot.
Oh, James, you slipped there.
I did. I forgot we picked up another hour on our Baton Rouge affiliate, WJBO. Glad you guys are listening in Tiger Country up there. Jennifer in Covington. Hey, Jennifer, you're next up on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you?
Hi, Gregory. Hi, James.
Hey.
I missed a little bit of the beginning of the show, and I think I probably already know the answer, but so this does not apply to Roth IRAs?
The stretch going away impacts all qualified accounts. So you have to take the money out over a 10-year period so that Roth can't just keep growing and growing and growing out there creating tax-free money. It's going to come out, and it's going to lose its tax-free status because it has to be withdrawn for a non-spouse beneficiary or none of the exceptions. Has to be taken out over 10 years as well. So it does impact it.
So it wouldn't actually make sense for me to be trying to roll over my regular IRA into a Roth IRA for the next, well, with the Trump tax cuts, till 2026?
Well, look, I still think Roth is a significant opportunity because it impacts more, maybe more, your life than leaving it behind. However, when you leave behind an inherited account that's a taxable account, that money's going to be taxed and forced into that window. There might, if strategically speaking, take advantage of tax brackets, there's some efficiencies in Rothing, not to pay Uncle Sam extra money, but create efficiencies over time. It's more of a conversation, and there's a number of things to look at versus having money that is forced to be spent down and could well be at higher tax brackets than you're exposed to now. So it is more of a conversation.
Okay. Then my second question is totally different. It's about my siblings and myself were part of a trust, and it's divided four ways, and it's basically just been sitting there. I need a few thousand this year, but I don't really know when I'm going to need what, and then it's left to the children at designated time. My father's grandchildren, the youngest at 35, will get half, and then the other half when he's 50, and then the trust ends. Do you know, or would I have to talk to Jude Heath, what is my tax burden when I'm on Social Security, disability, and Medicare, and I'm only 58, for taking any money from that trust?
Well, income can affect and cause Social Security to be inclusive and taxable. So if it is taxable income, it could well impact that. And that probably is a question to call Jude Heath's office. And you can find him, his connection, on my website, gregoryricks.com. Thanks for the call, Jennifer. Hopefully that is of help to you.
You want to stick with the phones here?
Yes.
William and Homa, you're next up on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, William?
Hi, guys. I got a question for both of you, either one of you. My retirement, I've been doing something that many years ago, 20 years ago, under Mary Lynch, they had a mutual fund called Top 10. So they no longer do that. And my 401k at work, what I do through Fidelity is I move my money to the one stock out of the 25, 30 that I have option. I move the money every month and a half, 2 months, when I know that I'm not paying commissions, to that top. And what I accomplished in 2019, I started with roughly 117, ended with 168. I know that that's a lot of risk. I'm 55. At what point I should maybe play with half of the money, or what do you recommend in the next decade?
So you say you're shifting that to a particular stock roughly every 6 weeks, shifting it to another stock?
The one paying the most is what I put the money.
Okay. Well, that does increase risk, and I guess if you've caught it right, it does. Well, the S&P 500 itself did increase 31.5%, and that's pretty diversified portfolio out there. Historically, it's about stock picking is a hazardous thing because most stocks don't outperform 30-day treasuries. With that said, how far away is retirement for you?
I'm 55. I'm hoping to live at least to 65.
Okay. Well, you've got another decade, so you have plenty of time. I do think diversification is important, and I don't necessarily think the goal should be to try to crush it every year, because you are also increasing yourself to downside exposure to get crushed that way. I think diversification and blending to where you increase the chance or probability of success. So that's kind of my thoughts on that. So when you get probably within 5 years of retirement is a focus to start preparing for it for sure. Okay. And make sure you're properly diversified and blended. Thanks for the call.
Robert, Baton Rouge, you're on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. What can we do for you, Robert?
Yes, sir. I work for a company that provides a profit-sharing plan, of which I cannot direct it, and I cannot contribute to it. In the last year and a half, I've had several coworkers retire, and they have waited up to 8 or 9 months to receive their payouts. Now, my research shows from the time that they retire, they have less than 30 days to receive their payouts according to the federal government. And I'm trying to make sure that I'm saying that what I'm saying is correct.
Well, here is where I go, because that's probably falling under ERISA guidelines. You have a plan administrator that should be handling that. So, you know, for example, with my company's 401k and profit sharing, we have a plan administrator, a firm that makes sure all the rules and everything are followed. And sometimes when there's overfunding and such and timing issues, they come in and say, hey, this needs to be adjusted, that needs to be fixed. And if I have plan, because I'm the one that designated the rules and tweaks those from time to time, but it still runs through that plan and they make sure everything's followed correctly and it has to be reported and there's filings to the federal government that has to be done. So my suggestion is you need to speak to your plan administrator regarding what rules you have in place and are they followed or not, and make sure they are adhered to. So hopefully that helps you, Robert. Thank you for listening to Winning at Life.
Thanks, Robert. All right. We do this 6 days a week, Monday through Friday at 7, Saturdays 10 to 1. No one does all our shows all the time. So download the Winning at Life app. And if you need more help from Gregory besides the show, tell him about your day job.
Yeah, I've got a day job. And you look, like the caller, sometimes we can't give you a lot of information. And honestly, there's probably, like just the last caller, there's a little bit more to drill down on. Two, if you need to have a conversation and not relegated to just a couple of minutes on the radio, and you've got something that, like, yeah, I've got questions, but I don't want to talk on there, call my office. If you want to set an appointment, whether it's in Gulfport, Mississippi, Mandeville, Louisiana, Metairie, Louisiana, or come to one of my events, check out the website, gregoryricks.com. The office number you need to anytime, any place, any office, 504-832-9200.
You're home away from the show, winningatlife.com and the Winning at Life app. I'm James Parker, and we are Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.
Investment advisory services offered only by duly registered individuals through AE Wealth Management, LLC. AE Wealth Management, Gregory Ricks & Associates, W.J. Blanchard Law, LLC, J. Heath & Company, and Mortgage Gumbo are not affiliated companies. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any references to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products, never securities or investments. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims-paying abilities of the issuing carrier. This radio show is intended for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be used as the sole basis for financial decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual situation. Annuities are insurance contracts designed for retirement or other long-term needs. They provide guarantees of principal and credited interest, subject to surrender charges. Annuity guarantees and protections are backed by the financial strength and claims paying ability of the issuing insurer. Hypothetical examples have been provided for illustrative purposes only. It does not represent a real-life scenario and should not be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual situation. Gregory Ricks & Associates is not permitted to offer, and no statement made during the show shall constitute legal or tax advice. Our firm is not affiliated or endorsed by the U.S. government or any governmental agency. The information and opinions contained herein provided by third parties have been obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed by Gregory Ricks & Associates. We are Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.